This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Power Perspective, of course, and we continue with the conversations of politics here. And I'm actually glad and actually, yeah, I dragged him into studio, and I've been stalking him and trying to find him for quite a while. But I can find him, but it's just, where do you find him and when's he not busy? Lukhona is in studio. Lukhona Mnguni is here. Yeah, bror.
Daddy.
Hey, chief.
Surprise.
Lukhona, surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
In the flesh.
How are you, my man?
I'm good.
You're looking good.
I'm keeping well. I'm looking after myself.
Mm. Mm.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm good.
Mm. I'm starting to gray like you.
You know, I started graying at about 35, bro.
Yeah, that's where I am.
Hereditary stuff in my.
That's where I am. I'm turning 35 in July.
Mm.
Believe it or not, people don't believe I'm youth, but I am.
Yeah, no. You look what? 48? 55?
Not a chance.
But are you good? Because,
I'm good.
You know, every now and again, I see you, then you home, then you back, and you home, and you back, and whatever.
And I go there a lot, yeah.
Yeah. Why do you go home quite a bit? Is it more, just is it you wanting to engage? Is it you to connect? Or you've always connected with home and the Transkei? Because me and you come from the same place. Basically.
No, of course. I mean, anyway, how rude of us! I haven't even greeted the people of power.
Yes,
I mean,
please.
Come on, man. Good evening, people of power.
Yeah.
It's beautiful to be here.
Yeah.
On Power Perspective. You know, Daddy. I mean. I'm still blessed to have grandparents.
Mm.
My grandmother turned 93
Wow.
in March.
Wow.
And my grandfather is turning 89 in June.
Wow.
So I try and spend as much.
She chose young.
She chose young. Funny enough you say that. My grandparents actually are quite an interesting anathema of their generation.
Mm.
In the sense that if you think about it, back then, it was often the man who is not just only older, but significantly older.
It was a thing.
Than the woman. And of course, women also just got married quite young.
Mm.
My grandmother married at 31.
Wow.
Had her firstborn at 33.
Yeah.
My mom. And they only had two kids.
Mm.
One sadly passed away very, very young. But we're a very small family, and I think across four generations, there's about 15 of us.
Wow.
It's a tiny family. So I'm blessed to have...
Which, tiny but connected then.
Tiny, connected. I mean, families have their dynamics, not always as connected as you may wish to be.
Mm.
But I mean, I'm blessed to have those two who are still very much self-sufficient. I mean, I've got sheep at home, and my grandfather is the perfect person to look after livestock. And he looks after all our livestock, our cattle, sheep, goats. And but besides the fact that I like spending time with them in person, there's just something renewing about going home that revives my soul and my spirit. It centers me. And therefore, because it's my place of centering, I try and go there as much as I can. I mean, I know that some folks say, for somebody who stays in Joburg, you go home quite often.
Yeah.
It is expensive.
Yeah.
But I mean, you have to choose where you deploy your resources the most. Mm. And I would rather I go home and slaughter a couple of sheep here and there from time.
Let's talk about that and let's engage the elections because that's why you're here. And I want to engage the elections with you in pretty much a chat.
Yeah.
And so when you go home and you drive home and you engage the Eastern Cape as you would engage the Eastern Cape and you would engage home as you engage home and you reflect on 30 years, what are you singling out as the change that would have happened in the 30 years? Where on the scale and what on the scale are the important things for you? How does that scale look? Does it positively, negatively reflect?
you know, it's a...
Let's disengage your ride home.
No, in fact, I wanted to say, let's look at it through the perspective of driving down from Johannesburg on the N3, Gauteng, Free State, KwaZulu-Natal into the Eastern Cape.
Yeah.
And you really see the various textures of life in the geography, in nature, and in people's lives.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, when I traverse and, you know, travel through the 30 years of our democracy, of course you see the mere fact that I can travel through these four provinces without anybody stopping me and asking me to prove why I am in this province and not the other province. I think we underestimate the power of the freedom of movement. Because it is in that power of the freedom of movement that we allow the spaces we meet and the interactions that we have to really encounter life and to be free and to experience real freedom. Because partly why I actually like going home is because I get to be in a place where my eyesight is not limited by the concrete jungle and the number of buildings that block my perspective. And I look into wide open spaces, and it allows the mind to travel and to see things. So I think, one, if I look at that freedom of movement, it's a really powerful breakthrough of our democracy. Now, of course, I understand that not all of us have that privilege to exercise that freedom of movement. There are still people, Denzel, when I go to the village, who don't leave the village for months on end just to go to the nearest town because they have no business going to the town.
And will never leave the village.
And some will never leave the village. And I remember one day watching news many years ago, probably 10 years, 12 years ago, but there was a lady, no, not a lady actually, there was a gogo. Because I remember that shot on SABC News quite perfectly. She went to Flagstaff at Home Affairs to get help. She was barefoot. I had a family grandmother who was like that. Even if she went to town, you know, most in our generation, when you go to town, you must look the part,
yes,
put on your best shoes,
you dress up.
No. The gogo says, "I don't want these things. What are these things?" After years of not wearing shoes, now I must wear shoes. So she was barefoot, goes to Flagstaff. But when she goes to get help at the Home Affairs can't help her. And they say for the kind of help that she needs, I think she was undocumented. And then if she gets documented, she'd be able to get her SASSA grant. And if she, then Flagstaff couldn't help her. They said, now they're getting closer to your hometown, Port St. John's. They say, no, go to Lusikisiki.
Yeah. I was born in Lusikisiki.
In St. Elizabeth. In Mpabane.
That's it. That's the hospital.
St. Elizabeth Hospital. I was also born there, by the way.
There you go. And you know why?
Yeah.
Because that was the hospital.
Yeah.
Port St. John's didn't have a hospital.
No, of course.
All the other areas didn't have a hospital.
And Holy Cross and Flagstaff was not that great. I mean, St. Elizabeth was the hospital.
That's it.
So I was born in St. Elizabeth as well. So they say to Gogo, no, go to Lusikisiki. Gogo says, no, no, no. She expresses this in his course, of course. But Gogo says, no, no, no. If these ones can't help me, it's okay. I'm going to go back home. It was already a lot of effort for me to come to this Home Affairs. Now you are sending me to a town I've never even been to. I don't know anybody. It's a 40 minutes driving distance between Flagstaff and Lusikisiki. And some people have never seen the nearest town. So I'm not taking lightly this freedom of movement. But also in that story I'm telling you is that in this 30 years of democracy, I've also seen what institutional failure does for people. Because here is a person who's taken money, time, but also a leap of faith to actually go to a place that she doesn't really go to. And she gets there and she can't be helped. And this is a story of many people in the 30 years of our democracy.
And
where
the thing she's looking for is identity.
The thing that she's looking for is identity.
Is identity.
I mean, I cannot tell you how much we've failed just at the one thing that gives you your confirmation as a South African, which is a birth certificate. There are so many kids who are not at school because they don't have birth certificates. Because in some schools they say, well, we can't keep you here because the government is not giving us a subsidy because you're not in the population registry. And so if we submit and say there's this child, but we can't prove that you are documented, it means that we might as well be inflating the numbers so that we can get some money and fleece it. So you have a problem of identity here in South Africa by virtue of so many people not being able to meet sometimes for real reasons, the 30 days that you are given to register a child after birth. Mm. And once you get over that 30 days, it becomes a nightmare. But in some instances, Denzel, you've got a young child whose mother has left home and left her with a grandmother. The grandmother is undocumented and the child is undocumented. It's even a worse nightmare in terms of the processes of home affairs that you've got to go through. So yes, in that 30 years of democracy, 30 years of freedom, there are people we have not even given the freedom of self. Who are you? You are a South African by birth, yes. But this thing that allows you to access your South Africanness, which is your ID, your birth certificate, you don't have it. The backlog at Home Affairs of people who have not collected their IDs, for example, and so on. So, but as you travel, Denzel, you also see the disproportionate way in which some spaces have really transformed. There are people who have really benefited from this democracy, where in some communities there's running water, there's housing, the people are able to farm, irrigate their vegetables and fruits and all of that. There are clinics that are close to communities. There are functioning schools with good leadership and good results. There are roads, whether they are tarred or gravel, but they are accessible, reliable roads that gives your freedom of movement good mobility. But it's very difficult to find all of these things in one community.
Yeah,
and so there is still a sense of brokenness. And I mean, my dear brother, Dr. Sizwe Mpofu Walsh, in one of his books, Democracy and Delusion, calls it, this thing of having to buy into a sense of gradualism in our development, that, this has happened in that community, so it will also come to my community one day. That community now has toilets, so they will come to my community. So I must be patient. I must wait my turn. And that conditioning has then allowed us to, at times, probably, in my estimation, domesticate, culturalize, and find acceptance in mediocrity or in being second best or in being treated as second class citizen.
Is it, Lukona, is it having an acceptance of mediocrity and understanding that it's mediocrity? Right? Is it that, or sometimes is it clouded in the real need for an asset, something, an improvement? How much of either is it? Because sometimes that hope that something will happen, I will get a house, something will come, is the reason I continue down a particular path. That's the one, and sometimes that particular hope is not linked to an aspect of mediocrity, and sometimes it's both. But do people engage that as separate entities?
No, look, I mean, Daddy, I don't think that in the day to day, everybody, I don't think in the day to day, we hold intellectual debates about our state of neediness. I think on the day to day we strive to get better. But I think what the thing about this idea that my turn is coming is that it tends to then lower expectations. That of course, sure, we have to be realistic. You can't deliver everything to everybody at the same time. But sometimes you can be a prisoner of hope, right? It's possible to be a prisoner of hope in that you live in perpetual hope. And the problem with being a prisoner of hope is that it then doesn't allow you to step back and say, can I make different choices? And now, of course, we're talking in the context of elections, which then says, can I step back and ask, can I make a different political choice, which may lead to a different material condition for myself if I tried to vote for a different political party over another, would the state of my condition changed? Because once you become a prisoner of hope, then also then doesn't allow you to step back and check whether or not the question of mediocrity is there.
Because you're so engrossed in it.
The question of, yes, sure, my turn is coming, but are there choices that the people who govern are making, allowing and permitting for me to really be next in line? So we've got to get to a point where, indeed, as you are saying, we get in conversation. I often say we've got to allow a conversation that says, how do we connect the value of the vote to my material conditions? I may be privileged to have a job, but how do I connect the value of my vote to how my taxes are used? The value of my vote to how I'm being driven by poor public goods and services to actually privatize a number of aspects of my life, from security to health to education and many other things that are out there. And you deem this a bare necessity to transport. I mean, you own a car, you're paying an installment on it, you're paying insurance on it, and then there's maintenance, there's petrol, which you don't know when it's going to next increase. And yet if there was good, reliable, efficient, and, you know, safe public transport, I probably would have, if it would cut out the car. And I don't just cut out the installment, I cut out the insurance, I cut out the maintenance, I cut out the tires, I cut out the petrol, I cut out this and that. And suddenly, you are confronted with a different question. If you solved public transport, who would stand to lose?
Lukhane, let me ask you this. Over the last 30 years, based on what you've just illustrated, have people moved? And you know what? It's one of those questions where someone would say, but that's what democracy is. Over the 30 years, we have brought so many people into the system. There, so many more people have health, so many more people have education, so many more people have this and that and that. But in essence, have we complicated those particular aspects where you say, you know what, the health issue, the education is now an issue, health is now an issue, my security is now an issue. Have we in essence then just moved government and its services and its responsibilities a little further away from the actual individual that needs it? And I'm not talking about in the democratic state. I'm not talking about the accessibility to it. I'm talking about the availability to it here and now. Has that gap sort of extended, or you know, the big broad democracy argument is, well, we brought democracy and so many more people are in the system, and you know what, people are engaging it, and before they didn't. What do you make of that particular question?
So I think it's an interesting question, because one of the things, sometimes when I look at the South African condition, because we inherited a vastly unequal society from apartheid and colonialism, unequal in a number of ways, access to land, special justice, unequal in terms of access to services, communal taps versus a tap inside every home, unequal in terms of electricity and all of these things. Now, because of that, when we think of government providing services, we simply think that government should provide these services for poor people because the rich already have them. The white population already had access to them. And therefore, the black, colored, Indian communities in differentiated ways of apartheid, if you worked in concentric circles, you'd say in your inner circle, you had the really privileged. And then as the circles, you know, almost the settlement patterns, right to the periphery where there's nothing. Now, when we then think of electricity, we think of government extending that which is at the core to the periphery. Of course, then, in an equitable world, you do need to start with the most vulnerable. But the aspirational world should actually be about those rights and entitlements that we have in our constitution, water, health and reproductive health, housing, food. Mm. These are constitutional rights that every South African is guaranteed to receive to a large extent through the mechanisms of the state. Whether the state makes a conducive environment for there to be investment, the ensurement of economic development, an increasing growing economy that creates jobs, jobs that are sustainable, that give people not minimum wages but living wages within the costs of living of the country and keeps up with the rates of inflation of the country, and that the state continuously ensures that the salaries of people meet the access to these particular basic entitlements that are in the Constitution. What we have allowed is a situation where these entitlements in the Constitution is, we say, the rich are already buying themselves into these rights. Effectively, you don't necessarily have the rights. You have the money to buy yourself into the rights. And this is why when people lose work and struggle to find work for a long time, they either suffer a lot of mental health, commit suicide, or suffer long-term depression. They can't deal because the state has not imagined a social security floor that says if you lose a job, you will still be guaranteed to have access to housing, access to water, access to food, access to health and reproductive health. Now, the point that you are
making... The net is not there.
The net is not there to cushion me. So when you have losses in the job market, actually the knock-on effect to society is much more vast. And then that community of people maybe who do not have, you know, our dependency ratios are still high. For every job, there's a high dependency ratio depending which sector you are in. But the people who then depend on this person who has a job, suddenly all they suffer because there's also not enough of a net.
There's a complete collapse.
Complete collapse in that particular household, in that particular family. But the more pointed point I want to make, Daddy, on this question that you are asking about. I've been saying for a number of years now, when I look at, so if government says, so I'm sure they're in my village, if I went to Pretoria, they'd probably say, tick, water project done. But there's a water project that was done 8 years ago. Not a single drop of water has come out of the taps. Now, I often talk about access because that's what government tells us. It often says now 92% of the people have access to whatever. 86% of households have access to water. I often say there are three elements we must talk about. It's access of the service. So we have access, availability. Service is available. But what is the quality of the water that flows out of these taps? Now, you've got to go read your blue drop reports and all of these things. Thirdly, yes, there's access. Yes, there's quality. Is there utility? So, yes, I'm receiving electricity. Yes, Eskom has not done load shedding, halala, halala, for so many weeks. But do I have a job to buy electricity and load the meter so that... And you often find in a lot of homes in villages, people use electricity for lights to charge their phones and the fridge to be kept on if they are lucky to have a fridge. They often still rely on other alternative forms of energy for fuel to cook. So they'll collect wood or they will use gas or they will use paraffin for stoves. And I'm not sure if you used primer stove. I'm not sure if there are still primer stoves.
People used cow dung.
Cow dung. For the driftwood and all of these things. So the point is this. When you say you've given somebody electricity and you say we must clap for you, we've got to ask, does that person have the means financially to buy electricity? I mean, it's a nightmare what is happening here. In the city of Tshwane, where I stay, city of Joburg, I used to say in the city of Tshwane, I buy prepaid metered electricity. Now, I know people will say, yeah, it depends when you buy. I can tell you, it doesn't matter when I buy. 500 bucks gives you 160 units. I bought this yesterday. 500 bucks gives you 148 units. So at some point, 500 bucks is going to give you 100 units.
Yeah.
Where's the 400? I mean, there's something that is not mathing in terms of how the state through rate, through these surcharges and markups they put on electricity. Mm. And municipalities have been warned that it is unsustainable to have electricity as such a big component of your revenue collection and revenue generation.
Which gets to the point of the state has moved closer, but the state has also
it's moving
extracted
away.
Itself.
The state is moving closer. Mm. The service is there. Yeah. But do I have utility to the service? Because what do you start doing? I mean, now, I've spoken on the side of poor people, because what I'm trying to show in this contrast of inequality is that state failure, in actual fact, affects all of us equally, whether you have or you don't. Because if suddenly 500 rands buys you 100 units of electricity, what do you need to do? You've got to cut the washing machine. You've got to cut the sense of things that you use in the household that eat up electricity. So what is happening is that your quality of life diminishes. Your buying power is eroded. And therefore, the fact that you have begins to mean very little in an environment of high inflation, irresponsible municipalities that keep charging us more money. There's Eskom this side, there's the municipality this side, and you just keep seeing that electricity being hit hard on to make the money. So those are the things that we've got in the 30 years of democracy to be talking about. The quality of life, even to those who have, is it really improving? Or our homes have become our psychiatric facilities.
I was speaking to somebody, and Basil in Boksburg, I'm going to take you in a second. I was talking to somebody the other day who said to me that they were homeless, they were moving. And I asked why. And they said they had put their home up for rent. And I said, why? And they said, because I can't afford to pay my house anymore. I could pay for my house, but now I have to put people to rent my house, and I have to move out, and I have to squat somewhere on somebody's couch or whatever, because I can't afford my house anymore. Let's take Basil in Boksburg. Basil?
Hi, Dee, and it's good to talk to Lukona. How are you, Lukona?
Fantastic, my brother. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm great. So mine is this. Even when Lukona was still in the very same station, you will host a minister, for an example. And to your point, Lukona, you find that maybe you're talking about passports or whatever, and the person, we the callers will call, and the minister will say, and that thing irritates the hell out of me. He will say, contact me directly, then I'll be able to assist. The reason it irritates me, it says the system is not working. And
because then it becomes becomes some form of a favor, and you're
exactly.
not engaging the system.
So the minister becomes some sort of a messiah. If he's there, then he delivers. Hence, you see communities saying, "We want to talk to the minister of police. We want to talk to the president." That should not be happening. If the system itself, because what about if I'm not listening to power? It means I'm not going to be assisted. Because the system itself must be able to filtrate all the challenges that we, the community, are meeting. So I'm agreeing with Lukona's analysis in terms of, does the system allow us to have quality of life in this country? And I think the answer is a big no.
Basil in Boksburg. Lukona, do you want to take that? I think you've spoken to a lot of that. He's reaffirming what you've said. Can I add to Basil in connection to what he said? And I want to park it now in election 2024. Everything Basil has said, and reaffirming what you're saying and the arguments you're making, are those particular narratives in essence in the way you're delivering them? And I started deliberately away from the election, and I wanted you to go on a very, very rural drive to the Transkei with me, and understanding that we'd be talking about those kind of politics. Are those politics and the issues as you've narrated them landing in this particular election? Are they landing from an acceptance that these are the issues that are important from political parties, or are they landing where people who are going to vote are bringing them to the table, and they will count when that person stands at that ballot box and makes a particular vote. From those two particular aspects, are they issues that are going to be dealt with from both sides? Are the ears of politicians listening, and are they attuned to that particular aspect? And or those that will vote, is there a strong enough urge that those issues are big enough for them to make a difference in 2024?
You know, I feel like starting off with the saying that says, "Ye that are hard to hear," sounds like something in the Bible. You know, this is what shall befall you.
It does sound like something in the Bible. It might be in the Bible.
It might be. It sounds Old Testamental.
It might be in the Bible.
But the politicians are hard to hear. Mm. And indeed, they are going to rip
Do a divide for me.
Okay.
The generalization of the politicians. Politicians in government, I want to make a distinction, because there's the 30-year report card that we can actually assess, and the new entrants into the political space who don't have an assessment that they have done, and we can't mark them because they're telling you what they will do.
So Daddy, there are very few politicians, like the one you were talking to, Prof. Mdwaba, in this election, who have not been in the political space in one way or the other. Some have sort of shuffled around. Some have sort of shuffled around. I mean, in the last 8 years, if you were to walk a journey and say who was in the DA in 2016 when we had that momentous breakthrough in the city of Johannesburg, city of Tswane, coalition government, stunning results, really, stand off results. Just like there's going to be a lot of stunning moments in these elections. But those people are no longer there in the DA. They are sort of shuffled around some other political parties, you know, Action SA, BOSA, and so on. So there may be new entrants on the ballot, but the individuals are not new entrants on the politics.
The chessboard, the pieces on the chessboard have stayed the
same.
And
this is partly where I'm going. So the tragedy of the last 30 years is that the failures of those who are in government have committed such a grave injury to the image of the politician. Even if that politician is somebody like Prof. Mdwaba, people like Yolerato Ngobeni's, Ayanda Ali from journalism spokesperson to politics, Songhezo Zibi from, you know, editor to this and that, but now in politics.
Rising.
Hopefully he's rising. You had Vuyiswara Mokgopa here, so maybe they are rising. But the point I'm making is that even those people I've just counted now, these are new entrants to politics. But because the image of politician has been so eroded, it will take a long time for them to redefine politics, or they will end up being swallowed by the very tainted image of the politician. Why? Even those who are not in government are struggling. I often say South Africa is an interesting place. The governing party is at its weakest. At its weakest, it's declining. It's going to lose Gauteng. It's going to lose KZN. It's likely to lose a majority nationally. It's likely to lose the Free State province. But the two parties that come after that are not experiencing a surge of support. In fact, you know, as Professor Madoda Fikeni said, the Democratic Alliance is self-mutilating in a corner unprovoked. They had all the ingredients of a party that could grow, and they did grow from a party of 1.7% in 1994, hitting 20%, over 20% in 2014.
Previous election. They were nice up in the 20s.
They were growing. You could see some growth. Then 2019 happened. And then the trajectory of the party just turns around, gets defocused, gets derailed, you know, starts losing sight of the big picture, consolidates, looks from within instead of from without to expand its horizons and become really a diverse political party. And that's partly because when it was confronted with making serious choices, the fact that a conference or congress, as they call it in the DA, nearly collapsed because there was a fight over whether or not diversity should be included as a fourth value in the values of the party. Tells you that the party was simply just distressed. That you can fight about being known for the party as a party of diversity, and there is a fight that nearly tears conference apart and collapses it. So you've got a problem in the South African politics where the weakness of the ANC is not the emergence of anything that actually can take the ANC on and, you know, win it. So what's going to end up happening in the South African political landscape over the next while is that the ANC is going to lose the power gradually, but there's not going to be an explosion into the political scene of a party that will become a 50% plus one party. And therefore, what you are probably going to be stuck with for the next 20 years or so are coalition politics, unless something between 2024 elections and 2029 elections really happens and there's a rupture in the political landscape of a player, of a personality that can really inspire South Africans truly from all walks of life, for them to walk into 2029 elections with a sizable majority or a sizable chunk of the vote that they could hold, let's say, a 40%. Now, you would imagine that a party that is almost there at 22% would focus on how to get to 30%.
Rather than 35.
Rather than being distracted, fighting what it calls small parties and parties that are not even in parliament or in any municipality. They don't even have one councillor, but you're spending so much of your time being distracted by other parties. So we've got a distracted politician in South Africa who is so self-consumed, cannot make means to strategize about being consumed about South Africans. And therefore, what this means is this story that Basil is telling, we continue. COSATU, if you remember, Dadi, used to call this a growing social distance. Vavi was still in COSATU at the time. A growing social distance between those who lead and those they lead. That growing social distance expressed itself in the first November 2021 local government elections, where voter turnout dropped below 50%. The nervousness I have about these elections is that if South Africans allow themselves to be so jaded by politicians that they've actually checked out of the politician. That's what, because if you don't turn out to vote, you check out and you check out of the politics. The problem is that it's going to leave them with a bad stew, a really tasteless stew of contaminated politics. Because if people want or they hope for change in these elections, it's what I call a turnout election. People have to stand up, they've got to wake up, they've got to walk out of their homes and get into the voting stations, they've got to queue up and stay in those queues when ballot papers run out, they've got to stay in those queues or leave and go back to those voting stations and cast their votes.
Is it because the reality is true as to what you started the argument with, is that even when good men and women then stand up and put their hands up, and the electorate has tuned out, you get caught up in that stew because there is no other, because the formula then is written for you, is that it's a mess. So even when good men and women do stand up and the electorate has tuned out and do not then go and support those good men and women because they've tuned out, because the politician has created that particular space for them just to say, I'm not interested, the good men and women then become part of a system then that continues to be rotten.
No, sure. And that's why many of the new ones who have not been in politics, when they go campaign in society, people ask them, how do I know that you'll not steal? How do I know you will not steal?
And you have to answer.
And you have to answer.
Yeah, you have to answer.
And then they say, no, you are starting to lie like the rest of them.
Yeah.
You see, now the measure. But why is that?
Yeah.
You know, there's that song that says, it's about apologizing, but not a good man. It's too late. Sometimes it's too late.
Let's take Praveen Pakta. Pro in Parktown.
Pro is having a conversation.
Pro in Parktown, can you hear me?
Yeah, Denzel, how are you?
I'm good, Chief.
I'm fine, man. I will be fasting, man. I want to support your guest then. Eh?
Luko Nanguni.
Luko, I love the guy, man. You know what, ne? I want to the previous guy who called, ne?
Yeah.
This is complain about the minister. What I want to tell you the truth. When Kgalema Mpante was the deputy president, was a general secretary of the ANC, ne?
Mm.
You can't see those guys. I used to go there to complain. They will block you and everything, Mara. When they need our vote, they come to us. Even their general secretary, you can listen. I want to thank you very much, Power FM. Darling Pof, even today, he's busy calling me and ask me what is about that thing I complain, and then he's taking the matter forward. Mm. And I met this woman, Mukhalif of the EFF. She's handling my problem, you understand?
Mm.
Those people of the ANC, you can't see them. When they need your voice, they will come there in the mukukus and everything. At Rutshuli House, you can't enter that building. I'm telling you. And look on Amunguni. You are analyzing a very, very, very interesting thing.
Pro in Parktown, I'm gonna leave it there because I've got 10 minutes left with Lukona. And Lukona, that's how time flies here. And
I'm actually surprised that we left with 10 minutes.
Absolutely.
But let's ask the question. For 5 years, a politician leaves. First of all, I've been wondering who's trying to kill these politicians. I mean, there are instances really where there are volatile conditions, certain provinces, pockets of things, blah, 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 blah.
Mm.
But this idea that the default is that somebody, the minute you become a politician, is trying to kill you is interesting.
Mm.
And people are really surrounded by a lot of security, a lot of gatekeeping, a lot of distance, and then they bully us on the road with their blue lights.
Mm. I made the example early on in the previous interview that everybody seems to have their cell phones at the moment. And as soon as the 30th of May comes,
now you're like,
cell phones will be changed. Cell phone numbers will be changed. And there will be three or four people that you need to get through to get to the prof who you could just phone up and have a chat with.
No, absolutely. Mm. And I mean, it's a political culture thing, Denzel.
Mm.
And we've got to get it right at some point. We've got to get services right so that it's not a system of favors. I mean, sometimes you really just have to get onto your phone book to get help in government.
Mm.
Because you've now tried everything that you can do. But because, fortunately, you've got a number of the DG, you've got a number of the minister, you've got a number of the head of hospital, some things that people don't have. You've got the spokesperson's number. So you say, Chief, help me out because I've been trying. Your people are not responsive on the ground. We cannot normalize that. That is not normal. And Basil was right and Pro is correct to say we've got to get to a point where the service works for everybody. It can be the service for those who are connected enough to try and bully the system, and therefore, because people think you're going to call them out when you do your open line here, therefore they are going to quickly get it done because it's Denzel. He's got the mic in front of him and he might be embarrass me in front of society.
Answer me this question, Lukona. And I don't get it. And you know, I maybe somebody else has the answer. Status orientation, where there is this absolute sudden, importance attached to an individual one day, and that amassing of so much more importance the other day, when in fact it should have been the other round. The day when you were not a politician, you should have been not available because nobody knew about you.
Yes.
But when you became a politician, that's the day you should have become available and more accessible. It's the opposite. Status orientation of people just thinking that others are beneath them, specifically where you get to the politicians. What drives that? Have we driven that and implanted it within the aspect of politics and politicians and given them that particular clout? Because I'll tell you something. You could be anybody from, and let me use this loosely, lowest rank, and you become engaged and somebody says, I anoint you tomorrow and you are a politician and I and I make you deputy minister of whatever, the transition of that particular person is
no, it's because again, I spoke of political culture. So you know, when you enter a system and it has a culture, so that culture then consumes.
You buy into it.
It starts by people accepting to lose their identity, which is the name that they were given by their parents. Mm. You stop being Lukona and you become MEC.
Yeah.
Everywhere you go, hey MEC.
Yeah. Honorable.
I'm sure you've interviewed people here. They come with MEC or DM or Deputy Minister is DM. Mm. You're no longer Lukona. You are DM, DG, DDG. Yeah. You've lost because the what you are saying, the status orientation has become the culture. That for as long as this is MEC, I must keep validating the position rather than the issues and the role and the need for governance.
Is it this, Lukona, too? I have had many an interview with a person, and I call you Lukona, and I have engaged people who I would generally engage with. And then I say, you know, Faith and whatever. And then somebody on the line would say, please respect them. They are MEC or whatever.
Yes, because,
or whatever.
Because the political culture.
And I am surprised that it would come from a caller or somebody
who should be seeing this person as the person. They should see themselves as the boss
Of this
person, because this person's access to political office depends on the electorate's support.
Yeah.
But you know, Daddy, over the years, one of the things that has been said about 1994 and its mistakes is that it amounted to the demobilization of society. Because then the citizenry deferred to the political leadership. To say, we've arrived at 1994, let's be free now to go look for work, let's be free to go do this, there's nothing, we're not going to struggle, we trust you, comrades, you are going to look after the country and ourselves within the ethos of the liberation movement. In that demobilization, what happened was the politicians were left to define a political culture. And once they had defined the political culture for a long time, they then perpetuated it into status, into class, into big man politics, into access, into patronage, into this and that. And so what has happened over time is that the political culture is actually one that is continuously trying to create society-wide patronage. That is why a part of the electioneering is really about making sure that you target around this time, so you'll see a lot of ribbon cutting, you know, whether it's Mamluku Kubai and Lebohang Maile, whether it's Tulas Nwesi and Allan Winde in the Western Cape. There's a lot of patronage that is being dispersed because you time these things around the election. And once, so the beneficiaries of patronage tend to then accept the rules that are defined by those they benefit from. So it's going to take some time to move away from that orientation, unfortunately. But there is that perpetuation of the political culture. And I think I'm seeing an interesting thing in these elections, though, where civil society is really trying to stand up to the politicians. I mean, whether it's in early childhood development, whether it's in health, whether it's in a basic income grant, whether it's in sex workers' rights and all of these things, civil society is actively saying to political parties, what are you saying about this? What are you saying about this? And you may have seen publications like Ground Up are beginning to actually publish on those. What are political parties saying on hunger and food security and all of these things? That is important because it means that there is an appreciation that the rules can no longer be defined by the political actors. The society and the people must try and reclaim their power in real terms, because effectively at the end of the day, the people who should be defining the political culture are the voters and making clear demands of the politicians.
Talk about reclaim, Lukona, in the last 3 minutes of the interview. Reclaim. So here we have 2024 and all the other characters are back, but we have some amazing talent paraded in front of us, and the bouquet is there. It's in front of us and we can choose. And from what we can choose are from the fish and chips to the caviar. And for some or other reason, in what I'm seeing is that the caviar is also struggling to deal with the fish and chips, to be elevated. On some other aspect, the caviar would would be showcased, and the caviar would be what you choose. Why is the caviar struggling as much or engaging as much as the fish and chips is? Are we not able, or has it become so clouded, this political space that you said that we engaged in, that politicians are now viewed with one particular lens, that people are not in a particular place where they can begin to differentiate that particular person over there is going to, if they do come in, do one, two, and three, and this one is at the end of their tank. It's empty. Why can we not differentiate? Why are we not able to differentiate proper from the talent in front of us and the that which has always been there?
Let's use the food analogy. You know, when you've been so hungry for too long that you've actually become full. So hungry for too long that you actually fear the choice of making. You fear the opportunity to make a choice on the food because you are not too sure how long that food is going to last. When you become so hungry for too long that you've even lost the sense of taste and smell. So hungry for too long that you've actually lost the sense of which food is better than the other. Or so deprived for too long that in actual fact, you can't even tell the caviar when it stares you in the face. Because it has no value to you. You've only known fish and chips. It's like taking a Ferrari daddy.
And now you're looking for food.
It's like, like taking a Ferrari to the village. The villagers will laugh at you. What are you doing with such a small car? Only two people can come in. Is it just for you and your wife?
Yeah.
Where will the kids sit? What are you doing? They diminish the entire thing. You've paid over $1 million for this thing. They say,
ridiculous.
Were they out of Ama Fortuna?
And the village can ridicule you.
Yes, because they don't understand why is this.
Yeah.
And you think you are bringing something of class.
Yeah.
But the utility of it. So the problem is that, unfortunately, for too long, the only dish that was available is the fish and chips. And this other thing you are bringing, salad,
caviar,
salmon, what are these things? Are they even food? Are they even edible? And that's why some people ask these new politicians, look at you, Mfanaka. Because they don't believe that you can stand up against what has been normalized as the fish and chips of politics. And therefore, that's why we talk in food about staple foods. Caviar is not a staple food. It's a luxurious taste.
Absolutely.
Can nibble on it.
Yeah. But the politicians in front of us are luxury at the moment because they could advance, they could exceed.
No, but this caviar you're talking about, even Tadi, we can even say this caviar you're talking about, even the twang, they speak differently, they're soft, they're soft spoken, they talk about care, they talk about this, they talk about that. But people say, but we're not used to this. And therefore it might well be that the new politician we talk about, its time probably has not come, or it has come too late and the damage has been done.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.